Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSwinney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Minister under fire. Calls grow for Veterans Affairs Minister Julian Fantino to resign as problems in his department continue to mount. Conservative Aaron O'Toole is here to address the issues in Veterans Affairs and how the government will fix them.
Is Canada missing its target in helping Syrian refugees? The government promised to bring 1,300 to our country by the end of the year, but so far less than 500 have arrived. We speak with NDP Foreign Affairs critic Paul Dewar.
The federal Liberals hire lawyer Cynthia Peterson to lead the investigation into the allegations of misconduct against two suspended MPs. The McLean's panel weighs in on what to expect.
And this week, the NDP put forward a motion to change Canada's federal elections by moving to a mixed-member proportional representation system. New Democrat Craig Scott joins us to discuss his attempt at electoral reform.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
When will the Prime Minister remove this minister?
Saturday!
That was the big question from the opposition this week as problems at the Veterans Affairs Department continue to pile up. At the start of the week, Minister Julian Fantino was under fire over a scathing Auditor General's report on mental health services for vets. And he took heat after his department claimed the $200 million in funding to deal with that issue was being spent in 6 years when it's actually spread over decades. Fantino defended himself when NDP leader Thomas Mulcair attacked him for flying to Italy for the 70th anniversary of the Italian campaign instead of being in Canada to address these problems.
I attended a very moving commemoration in Italy involving those soldiers that were there during the war, saw them visit the graves of their comrades in the various cemeteries. And I'm very proud of having done that, Mr. Speaker.
Absolutely.
And in my world, lest we forget, means something.
Hear, hear.
The Honourable Leader of the Opposition.
How about showing up for work and taking care of them when they're alive?
Hear, hear.
The issues kept popping up. Later in the week, we learned Veterans Affairs missed its target for preserving soldiers' graves, spending $2.6 million less than budgeted and only hiring 8 employees instead of the 41 they were supposed to. The government was also in court trying to get a lawsuit thrown out. The suit was launched by 7 veterans and is over the government's changes to disability benefits. All of these issues prompted calls from the opposition for the minister to resign or be fired. But Prime Minister Stephen Harper hasn't done that. Instead, he's leaving Fantino where he is and has appointed the Director of Media Relations at the Prime Minister's office as the minister's interim chief of staff. The NDP attacked the government once again, but Harper had a return jab.
Ministers, of course, have chiefs of staff. I gather even the leader of the NDP has a chief of staff, obviously watching over the slow descent of that particular party.
Now, over the last month, we have made several requests to speak with Minister Fantino, and once again, we've been told he is not available to do an interview. Instead, the Conservatives have put forward Aaron O'Toole, the Parliamentary Secretary for Trade, who served as a pilot in the Air Force. I spoke to him in the foyer of the House of Commons.
I guess my first question is going to sound a little odd, but why am I talking to you? And I ask that because, I mean, the minister hasn't publicly spoken outside of the House of Commons since before the AG's report came out. We've had many media requests. He's not doing interviews at all to talk about this. Where's the accountability on this file when the minister isn't addressing these issues?
Well, the minister's answered dozens of questions in the House this week, but clearly there's a lot of politics swirling around all of these issues. Why I'm out here is because I served in the Canadian Forces and I've worked on these issues for many years, and some of them are not very well understood. And the case of the Auditor General's report, it was actually the minister who asked the Auditor General to see how we were doing on mental health for veterans, because we've been spending a lot more money in the area and we want to make sure that it's meeting the expectations and needs.
But, I mean, reading answers off a piece of paper in question period is a little bit different than coming out and speaking to reporters who have a lot of questions about the issues that are happening right now in his department.
I think clearly in the last week there's been the opposition has set up a sort of narrative that is just about the minister, and it's actually confusing a lot of Canadians with respect to what veterans receive. The lump sum is a great example. We've heard talked about this week. The most critically wounded veterans from Afghanistan get more than just the lump sum. You don't hear the opposition talking about that.
But there is ministerial accountability. I mean, he is the boss of his department, so it is about the minister in a way, because when there are a lot of issues and complaints from veterans, somebody has to answer to that, and it usually should be traditionally the minister.
Well, the minister certainly sets the direction for the department and the policy, and that's why you've seen record investments in the last number of months in mental health specifically. That's why you've seen the minister ask the Auditor General to critique how we're doing. We want to make sure that we're spending more, but it's going to frontline services, not back office administration. We wanted to see how we can get delays down to meet the goals of serving people quickly, getting veterans transitioned and retrained, and getting the mental health support. So the minister, that's the most important role, is actually setting the direction, setting the priorities.
There are a lot of complaints out there, everything from the Auditor General's report raising issues about the timeliness of the mental health services and how veterans get them, to the preservation of grave sites. There were a lot of complaints from veterans over the closure of those offices. It seems from the public perception that there are many problems. What would you say is the biggest problem in the Veterans Affairs Department right now?
I think we have to communicate what we're doing better, and I think everyone can be involved in that, including me. Canada faces a unique challenge because we have veterans in their 20s and 30s in some cases who are war veterans, many who are wounded, both physically and mentally. Canada has not seen that for 50 years, since World War II, where we're actually, Veterans Affairs is dealing with evolving issues that it hasn't confronted. 25 years ago, Cormac, it used to be a ministry that did more commemoration and memory, which is important, but now they're having to adapt to the needs of the Afghan generation of veterans. It's doing some things well, some things need to be improved. That's why the minister asked the Auditor General to do it, but that's the central challenge, is making sure that people understand we're evolving Veterans Affairs to meet the needs of veterans who are in their 90s, but also veterans in their late 20s who are war veterans.
Do you think that 1,000 jobs cut from the department over the last 5 years has impacted services?
I don't at all. You know, if you look back at the offices that people still don't understand, I've heard members of the opposition call these Veterans Affairs offices as hospitals and service centers. That's not the case at all. They were administrative centers to help with forms. The Royal Canadian Legion and their veteran service officers does a lot more than those offices ever did and have for 50 years. We now have veterans who are managing their own VAC account online. The younger veterans, that's the way they're going. They don't even go into banks with bank books in their generation. So we have to make sure that we have the services there. That those offices were from the 1950s, when Service Canada didn't exist, where Canada didn't have a public health care system. The country's changed. We now have the ability to have that administrative support in more geographic centres in Canada through this move to Service Canada. It will actually serve veterans better over time.
But veterans complain that the service has gone down for them. They don't have the access that they once had. The paperwork has become a massive issue for them because there are too many steps to go through. It's something highlighted by the AG as well. Do you have anything to base that on, that services are working just fine? Because the complaints seem to say otherwise.
Well, the vast majority of veterans I speak to feel that they're well served by Veterans Affairs. Do they think there could be some improvement? Absolutely. Most veterans are concerned that potentially other people are falling through the cracks, but most can't actually point to people. Even veterans advocates, some you'll see on television, they can't speak to any problems with their own case, but they're worried about their comrades. I am too, as a veteran. The reality is most are well served. Mental health is a big area of challenge that we've got to improve. That's why we've been investing hundreds of millions of dollars. The Auditor General showed we, in 2012-13, we spent $500 million. We've set aside $200 million more to make sure we meet the needs. But we also want to make sure that it's not just about the money, it's about how they're accessing services.
But how can you say that services haven't been impacted when you're missing targets on a number of issues? Preserving grave sites, one, where you have far fewer employees working on it, less money being spent. The AG highlighted that the targets for mental health services are not being met as well. We're having staffing issues. The AG also said that he's heard that case managers are overworked. How can you say that services are okay when we start to see all these numbers? Like, do you have any other numbers?
I do look at the numbers regularly, and this is something that's not well understood. There's tens of thousands of veterans, but most don't actually use any services from Veterans Affairs at all. In fact, there's only about 8,000 veterans that have an assigned case manager. Those are the most complicated cases. For ones with mobility issues, whether they're young or old, a Veterans Affairs caseworker will go to their home to serve them. So there's this is about building in flexibility, the allowing basic support through Service Canada, working with the Legion to make the forms easier, to reduce the paperwork. We've reduced the paperwork for the Veterans Independence Program because we've heard from veterans' families on that. So I look at the numbers quite regularly, and this is about building flexibility into the system. The bottom line, we're spending more money at a time that the overall number of veterans is going down because of the World War II cohort.
But the number of veterans accessing the services has only gone down by 7%. Job cuts have brought staffing down by 25%. That's a big difference.
In the vast majority, Veterans Affairs is interesting. It's one of the few ministries where the vast majority, over 80% of the funding, goes to frontline services. You see, Veterans Affairs, some of the reductions in staff have come as a result of getting rid of the back office, getting rid of a lot of the form transfer. So there's hundreds of thousands of forms that have been taken out of the system by our changes over the last few years. And you're looking at a basic sort of attrition approach to making sure that the money we're investing, more money, goes to frontline services and not to, you know, the back office, the way things were done a long time ago.
Why are managers getting big bonuses while jobs are being cut? In 2011, 2012, there was almost $350,000 given out to 60 managers while jobs were being cut then.
Well, the public service has performance requirements and measures in all of their contracts. To be honest with you, I'd also like to see the opposite if performance isn't met. You know, so there, we often sometimes talk about the bonuses, but I'd love to see the Treasury Board look to see that senior staff, if you're not meeting the needs, say for mental health, there shouldn't be a bonus, there should be a reduction. That's where we have to go. But this is something that applies to all departments. You're looking at certain things like the cemeteries issue the Liberals brought up this week. 6 months ago, they were complaining we spent too much money on commemoration and memory and things like this. So the politics is swirling heavy on this.
But it's not just the opposition. I mean, from the public perception, jobs are being cut in the department, veterans are complaining about services or lack thereof, and you get a report from the Auditor General that's scathing, and we find out that managers are getting bonuses as a result of all of this.
A lot of these stories have combined to create the sense that there's a lot of problems. The Auditor General report is one we asked for. We asked to see how we were doing so that we can get better, make sure the money we're investing is going to where it needs to, the veteran. You look at stories that have come out about estimates and lapses and total mischaracterizations of how the government spends money, those are political. You know, you have MPs who know full well how main estimates and the public accounts work, but they're playing politics and games on this.
There's no doubt that there is at least a PR problem. I mean, you have veterans who are complaining about this, veterans who are openly saying, used to vote conservative, not going to vote conservative anymore. You're saying the services are fine. How do you fix this, though?
I don't like, as a veteran myself, I don't like to see any veteran who's frustrated or doesn't think that politicians on any side of the House don't have their best interests at heart. The reality is we do. But we have an obligation to make sure we're meeting needs, not just the way they were done after World War II in the 1950s. We have to evolve this department. We're spending more, but it's not just about the money. It's about making sure we meet rising needs like mental health, meet the needs of the new generation of Afghan soldiers. If we need to communicate that better, that's why I meet veterans across the country. We're fixing the Liberal New Veteran Charter in a way that I think will show Canadians that our modern veterans are well provided for.
On the Veterans Charter, the committee has put forward recommendations that haven't even been touched yet by the minister. So aside from communications, will there be any policy changes moving forward to try and address some of the current concerns that have been raised?
Yes. There were 14 recommendations by the Standing Veterans Affairs Committee. The minister asked them to look at the Liberal New Veteran Charter. There was 14 recommendations. We've moved on 4 already, but I can tell you there's other changes that are coming. We're committed to it.
From the committee's recommendations?
You'll see action on more of the 14. We're committed. That's why we asked for the committee to look at the Liberal New Veterans Charter to see how it can be improved. We're fixing it. We've made a critical fix a few years ago, and the 14 recommendations, I think, are a good start to make sure we're serving veterans.
That was Parliamentary Secretary Aaron O'Toole discussing the issues in the Veterans Affairs Department.
Still to come on McLean's on the Hill, the government may be missing its target for taking in Syrian refugees. The Liberals hire a lawyer to investigate the misconduct claims against two suspended MPs. And we look at the NDP's efforts on electoral reform.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, the McLean's panel weighs in on the Liberal plan to investigate two suspended MPs, and the New Democrats try to make changes to Canada's electoral system. But first,
as the war against the Islamic State terrorist group continues in Iraq and Syria, Canada appears to be falling short on its commitment to help Syrian refugees settle in our country. 2.5 million people have fled Syria to neighboring countries due to rebel clashes with the Assad regime that began in 2011. The situation has gotten worse since Kurdish fighters and an international coalition launched the war against ISIS.
The government promised the United Nations it would bring 1,300 refugees to our country, but since July 2013, we've only brought over 457. While the opposition says this is a big failure, the Parliamentary Secretary to Immigration, Kostas Menegakis, says that's not the case.
More than 1,100 refugees from Syria have been approved to come to Canada. In fact, more than 1,150 have been approved to come to Canada and will be here in short order. They will join the more than 1,900 Syrian refugees that are here that have been granted protection in Canada since the start of the Syrian civil war. Mr. Speaker, we can and we will do more.
To speak more about the issue, McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes caught up with NDP Foreign Affairs critic Paul Dewar.
Before we get into the new developments this week, can you just refresh our memories on what is Canada committed to and when did we commit to it?
Well, you need to go back a couple of years, and in fact, it was the Foreign Affairs Committee that studied the whole issue of Syria. We made recommendations from our committee, and actually it was an NDP motion to study the crisis in Syria. And out of that came the recommendation for the government to take on Syrian refugees. So we're going back a couple of years now in terms of, you know, the crisis started in 2011. In 2012 and 13, the Foreign Affairs Committee actually did a study on Syria, and we made recommendations. The government then accepted those recommendations, of which one was to take, they accepted to take 1,300 refugees. So over that, since that time, over the last couple of years, we've been asking the government, well, how many have actually arrived?
Hard to get those answers as I hear.
It was, you know, there was both Minister Kenney and Minister Alexander who just wouldn't come clean as to exactly how many Syrian refugees had come. You know, we get numbers that were mixed up with, you know, people who had fled the crisis in Iraq, who had been documented, and they were mixing those numbers up with the Syrian refugees. But after persistence, frankly, from everyone, from the media, from questions in the House, we just recently had...
Just yesterday,
we got some numbers, but just before that, we actually had Minister Alexander tell us that they actually hadn't got the 1,300 in. So the answer we got yesterday was the exact numbers, and it was a real shock. We had noted that the government had claimed, and it is true, that they had sponsored over 200 refugees. But when it came to 1,300, they didn't even meet half of their commitment. In fact, were able to realize was 457 out of 1,300 over a couple of years.
And some of those is that 457 government sponsored, or is that government plus private?
So this is government plus private. There was just under 300 were government, and the rest were private sponsorships. And here's the problem. The government has done nothing to really push the sponsorship from Canadians. They have said, well, people haven't come to us. We're not able to realize the numbers for the private sponsorship. And my point is they should be out there working with communities to help them in terms of sponsorship, because it does take a lot of effort for groups to come together to sponsor refugees, and it shouldn't be just all on citizens.
And they have to make a sort of a financial commitment.
That's correct.
To do
yes,
that, right?
Yes,
to support the people
support for over a year and other responsibilities. But this calls into question two things. One is, why didn't the government tell us the truth? I mean, frankly, they could, you know, all they had to do is answer a simple question. They got caught in their own talking points. I don't think they wanted to tell people exactly what the numbers were because they were so, frankly, pathetic.
Could we put this in some context?
Yes.
It is I don't know how many Canadians are aware of what a massive humanitarian problem we've got here. It's really the by far the biggest refugee problem of our era, is it not? Like you've been in the region.
Absolutely, absolutely. This has been going on since 2011. The crisis has now had spilled over into Iraq, as we know. But let's go back to 2011. We had a situation where Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, and yes, even Iraq was having to absorb hundreds of thousands and now millions.
I believe 3.8 million is the number now.
Exactly.
It's almost beyond comprehension.
It's hard to even comprehend, but let me put it this way. It would be analogous to having most of Toronto emptied out and in a couple of years.
So three neighboring poor countries, Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, have had to absorb millions of refugees, and Canada has taken 450?
Exactly. And so we've been asked by the United Nations Human Rights Commissioner, Mr. Gutierrez, who visited here. I met with him, the government met with him last year, and he pleaded with Canada to take at least 10,000 in the next 2 years. And we can't even muster up enough resources to take in, the 1,300 we had promised before. So we're way behind. So this is about, frankly, in the end, about the competence of this government, but also the commitment and the values that most Canadians associate with Canada being called into question, frankly. We've seen Germany, Sweden, and other countries.
Germany's taken a lot of refugees.
Tens of thousands. Yeah. Sweden, anyone who arrives on their shores is allowed in. We see others pulling their weight. And the disturbing piece is not only that this government failed to meet its own meager commitments, they boast about how we're leaders in the world. We're not. And the government has been outed and the minister's been outed by his own numbers as of yesterday.
Do you think one of the problems here is making sure that the refugees that come to Canada from Syria are not posing some kind of security risk? Is it getting that kind of an evaluation done that might be holding up some of the applicants?
I think the government has to answer that question. I certainly worked with the community early on. And when that was brought up, the community was very clear about those who they were going to sponsor would absolutely have to be cleared for security purposes. They get it. I mean, who wants to bring in people who are going to be a security threat? No one. Hmm. So there are ways to ensure that the people who are coming are going to be cleared in terms of a security check, but also that the people who are going to be sponsoring them understand that, they don't want to be on the hook for bringing in people who are a danger to, or threat to our country. So I don't think that washes. And I think if you look at, our allies, they're certainly able to do this. And they aren't, they're able to do it with having security checks as well. So this is a matter of, it's really in the end of the day, it's not a matter of a way, it's a matter of a will. And is the government willing to do its part? Next week's very important because the conference in Geneva.
This is a conference at the ministerial level of countries to talk about the refugee crisis.
And this will be an opportunity for Mr. Alexander and for our government to actually deal with the unfortunate record we have to date. And the question is, will the government realize the opportunity to do what Canada has done in the past, what we should be doing now, and accept at least 10,000 refugees over the next 2 years, at a minimum.
That was Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes, speaking with NDP Foreign Affairs critic Paul Dewar.
It's now time for the Maclean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Aaron Wherry, the Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine, and Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Thanks very much for joining me.
Great.
All right, we're going to start off with the news that the Liberals have hired a lawyer, Cynthia Peterson, to conduct the investigation into the two suspended MPs over allegations of personal misconduct. John, you've been looking into this. How is this investigation going to unfold?
Yeah, just a quick look into it. According to the Liberals, Cynthia Peterson, who's a big-time lawyer with some interesting experience, is going to be ready by around Christmas time, around the Christmas break, to start talking to people in earnest about this. They said that she's going to be available to talk to any of the four MPs involved, the two making allegations, the two who have allegations thrown against them. It's not clear that they've agreed to talk, because the way they worded it is she's going to be available to talk to them if they want to talk. Interestingly, they stress repeatedly in their prepared statement on this that the report Peterson produces is going to be for Justin Trudeau, a confidential report collected confidentially for the leader and meant to give him some guidance on whether to let the two MPs who've been suspended back into caucus and let them run as Liberals again. Interesting point about Cynthia Peterson is that along with being a big-time courtroom litigator who's been at the Supreme Court many times arguing Charter of Rights cases, she's the counsel for the Law Society of Upper Canada, the very powerful organization of Ontario lawyers, on harassment and discrimination matters. And in that respect, she gave a speech last spring where she talked about how one of the big things about that process she oversees there is that it's an informal and confidential process. So she's got some experience with doing these kind of things behind closed doors.
The confidentiality of this, and I guess the fact that the report may never be made public, is probably a way to try and bring in the NDP MPs who are nervous about going forward after everything that happened.
Very likely.
All right, so we're going to switch topics a little bit then to the Senate. The Senate currently has about 16 vacancies in it, and this new Speaker of the Senate was out this week talking about how he needs to get these seats filled so that the Senate can continue with its work. He's having problems getting some work done, and I imagine he's talking more about committees. Aaron, what do you think about this? Because the Prime Minister has openly said, I don't want to touch this. I haven't heard Canadians saying that they want those vacancies filled. So it doesn't appear like he's going to be filling these seats anytime soon.
Yeah, the Prime Minister had a pretty interesting take on this. His response was, you know, as you say, first and foremost, people aren't asking him to appoint senators. But the second part was, as far as he's concerned, the Senate is fulfilling its functions in that it's passing government legislation. That's an interesting way of looking at it. That's not really what the Senate is there for, in theory. The Senate is supposed to be there to scrutinize legislation and to provide regional representation. So if we're throwing those two options out, if we're saying it's not important that it scrutinize legislation, if we're saying it's not important that it represent the regions, then to me, it doesn't seem, the question isn't so much that maybe we have 16 vacancies. The question is, why do we bother with 89 senators that we still have? Quorum is 15. So shouldn't we just reduce it down to 15 and stick with those, and they can stand up every once in a while and say, are we going to pass this legislation? And everyone will say yes, and things will go on. I think the Prime Minister has set up a kind of bizarre argument here. He's essentially decided, I guess, that the Senate really doesn't have a purpose. It doesn't really accomplish anything or isn't really there for any reason. So I think then the onus comes back on him to say why he thinks his appointees should remain there. He could tomorrow ask his remaining appointees, I think there's about 50 or so left, to resign. That would save us some money. The other thing he could do is say, okay, well, I'm just going to make sure that we have a conservative majority in the Senate, which would leave about 10 extra senators. So again, if the Prime Minister is really serious that this argument, that the Senate's only purpose is to pass government legislation, then the question becomes not so much these 16 that we're missing, but why are we even bothering with the ones that we have?
Is this just some sort of way to bleed it out and bring some sort of reform in that way? Or is this just the perception of the whole thing to the public where he doesn't want to be seen as supporting an institution that's caused a lot of scandal?
I think more the latter. I mean, if you think about Harper's history on the Senate, he was reluctant to name senators for a long time. Then he named a whole bunch when he was in danger of, you know, when they were coming up to crucial points, elections, and Tory numbers in the Senate were finding. And then he seemed quite willing to appoint some regularly for a while when he had a plausible claim that he was going to introduce Senate reform. That door was closed by the Supreme Court, essentially. So there's not going to be any significant Senate reform, which puts him back in the position he was in his early days of, well, how do I, given the rhetoric I've used in the past about the need for a reform Senate, how do I keep appointing senators to an unreformed Senate? I suspect he'll one day appoint some senators again. That would be my guess. But there's no question it's politically awkward as long as things stand the way they do now.
Would that even happen before the next election? Well, he may not want to do it.
Yeah, that, I think, is the question. Yeah. And this is where I think it gets really interesting is the Prime Minister could probably go till next October without appointing another senator, unless a citizen steps forward and challenges them, through the courts, unless the provinces get very angry about it. He could probably go until next October without appointing another senator. But then what happens? Well, if the Liberals form government, they've got their own promise of what they're going to set up. If the NDP forms government, well, they want to abolish, so they'll presumably pursue that. if Stephen Harper is reelected, if he continues to be prime minister after next October, what does he do?
He needs because middle ground, Aaron.
He can't just continue on not appointing senators. It'll eventually become a challengeable situation. And then, even if he's not prime minister, what is the next conservative leader going to do? What is their position going to be on the Senate?
They need a middle ground, don't they? Between, like, they've always said that elected, accountable senators, you know, and some of the, that's too hard to do constitutionally. So I think they need to find some kind of middle ground that makes the Senate at least passably respectable. You know, but it falls short of either abolishing it or truly reforming it, which is a tall order. I don't think that anyone should say it's a simple thing for any prime minister to get around that. It's really tough, but probably needs to try something.
All right, and we're going to switch topics again to Syrian refugees now. It's been an issue this week because the government had promised the UN that it would take in 1,300 refugees from Syria, which began in 2011 when there were a rebel uprising in Syria and clashes with the government forces. Mm-hmm. And that's gotten even worse now, given the issues with ISIS and the coalition effort there. But we've only taken in to date about 450 and maybe a little bit more.
Yeah.
And we're well shy of our target with only a few weeks left. John, yeah. What's the issue here?
It's a complicated situation. Part of the problem is that the government put a lot of the onus on sponsoring refugees on private individuals rather than making them government-sponsored refugees. It's much harder for private individuals to go through all the hoops and put up the money required to guarantee support for refugees when they come here. It would have been easier and quicker if they were government-sponsored refugees. They may have to revisit that decision. There are also questions, although I have trouble getting clear answers to this, on security clearance for people who applied for refugee status. There's obviously concern about picking people out of that volatile region, making sure we're not taking in people who are going to be problematic when they get here. So there's a whole bunch of problems. And also getting assurances that refugees who come here will, on a temporary basis, would return home if things somehow stabilized. So there's a whole bunch of problems. But when you cut through all that stuff, countries like Germany have taken tens of thousands of refugees. We've taken a few hundred. There's almost no question that what has to happen here is there needs to be more responsibility taken by the government, some of the burden taken off private sponsors. And I think, too, it has to be asked now whether or not the government shifted its attention to being part of a military mission there and pulled some of its attention and focus away from this part of the humanitarian response. So I think they must be a bit embarrassed by the numbers that are coming out right now, and I suspect there'll be some action in the coming weeks on this file.
All right, thanks very much, guys. Appreciate it.
Great.
I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. And as always, thanks again for joining us. Co-host Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine, and Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Guinness.
Still to come on Maclean's on the Hill, we speak with NDP's Craig Scott about his efforts to bring proportional representation to Canada.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
It's less than a year to go until the next election, and this week the NDP used its Opposition Day motion to try and bring in some electoral reforms, specifically mixed-member proportional representation. The party wants to end the reign of the first-past-the-post system that we've been using since 1867 when Canada became a country.
Despite the best efforts of the New Democrats and even the votes of some Liberals, the motion didn't pass the House. To explain the motion and the need for electoral reform, I spoke with the NDP's Democratic Reform critic, Craig Scott.
So I guess first of all, Craig, could you just explain what the NDP proposed this week?
We proposed to get MPs to concede and agree that we should abandon winner-take-all system and replace it with proportional representation with a concrete proposal for something called mixed-member proportional representation used in Germany, Scotland, and New Zealand, just to give three examples.
And so how would that work exactly?
Well, mixed-member proportional involved, the mixed-member refers to the fact there are two pathways for MPs to be elected to the House of Commons, and that corresponds roughly to two votes that a voter is given on one ballot. They vote as they currently do for who they want to be their local MP. Key point, you continue to have a local constituency MP. The second vote, you move to the other column on the ballot. And the second vote is for a list prepared and presented by a party. You decide which party you want to support. Then you, partly on the basis of whether you like their list of people that could, some of them could end up in Parliament, in the House of Commons. And under the system that is widely understood that it would have to be in Canada, you would have the further choice of not just saying, I like this party list, but I prefer this person on the list, and that's who I want to give my support to. So that's called a flexible list approach to supporting a party. So there's a local MP vote, a party list vote, where you have flexibility to choose a person in the party. The locally elected MPs go to the House as they currently do. That will usually, in our system, produce a distortion. Some party will have too few and some too little. And it's from the party lists that that distortion is corrected so that each party has the percentage of seats that corresponds to their percentage of support.
One of the issues that gets brought up, and I think it was brought up in the House this week, was this question of the lists and how they're drawn up, where they come from, how names get on that list. So how do you envision those lists being drawn up?
Well, let me take one step back, which is that beyond our commitment, we've already been long committed and specifically committed to making 2015 the last unfair election. Tom made that commitment loud and clear on Democracy Day 2013. I went out to Victoria a week ago to deepen the commitment with a process commitment. We want people to know they can hold us to something, because people are cynical, skeptical, and cynical with good reason about promises at election time. We want them to know what we will do in order to meet that last unfair election promise. So we would, if in government, create a special task force that would be all party in the sense that representatives from different parties, they wouldn't necessarily have to be MPs, working with experts and with wide consultation of citizens to design the mixed member model. There are so many institutional design choices within mixed member model that the collaborative process to figure out what is the best version adapted for Canada is crucial. Then, within, let's just say, a little over a year, a task force recommendations would be turned around into model to legislation by the government, and then the legislative process would take over with the goal of having it legislated and ready to be implemented for the 2019 election. So that's key. Those two process commitments are added to our belief in the system. So one of the institutional design points, the reason I took that time, is one of the institutional design points is precisely what should the law say about the lists. And one of the things that I would be pushing for if I were in government is that although you'd be saying to this task force, please recommend the 12 to 15 design features that are needed, two would be taken off the table and you just have to figure out how to tweak them. One would be those lists should be flexible. Flexible lists mean you can choose to tick the party and accept the order that they've put the names in, or you can choose to say to the party, thank you, but no thanks, I prefer number 5 on the list as opposed to number the way you've put the order, and I hope a number of other people do that too, in which case number 5 moves up the list and maybe in Parliament. The second is that for big provinces, you cannot have province-wide lists because the provinces are too big. There's not enough commonality of background and interest, and there's not enough capacity for people to really know who the list candidates are. You need to have smaller regions than province-wide regions for the big provinces. So Alberta, BC, Ontario, and Quebec would need to have sub-provincial regional lists. The smaller provinces, probably starting with as small as Saskatchewan and Manitoba with 14 members of parliament, would probably be the regional list, would be the provincial list. But that part is up for grabs. It could be that even Manitoba and Saskatchewan you divide in two and have two regions of 7 or something. And so the way in which the lists would be created would mirror, well, how is it that parties currently choose candidates through electoral district associations? What kind of internal democratic process would be needed? And then we would be into almost a Chong reform bill debate about how much the Elections Act, as modified, says this is how you must do it versus this is how you may do it, but you have to tell everybody how you've done it. So that becomes part of their decision-making on whether they want that list. So Party X says, we asked the leader to give us a list. Don't think a lot of people would be very impressed by that. Party B says, we do this in some kind of a regional convention for the regional list, and it's almost like in the way in which we elect leaders through convention, we do it, maybe we do it online. Party C does it through some kind of allocation within a region, having electoral district associations collaborate to suggest names. Who knows? The NDP would almost certainly have proactive diversity and equity rules that would suggest that, for example, there's a method called zippering that are used in some countries where every second person on the list should be a woman. In a country like Canada, we may want to take other demographic considerations into account, especially, for example, if we want to see it as one mechanism to deepen a degree of integration of Aboriginal representation within the House of Commons as opposed to other mechanisms that are still needed.
Is it fair, though, that an election would be enough of a mandate to go ahead and change the electoral system, or do we need a referendum that gives people choices? You know, that which has been a proposal of the NDP in the past, which would have, you know, put forth a referendum to decide this instead of going with an election.
We've clearly in the past associated ourselves with a referendum as being almost certainly going to turn out to be the best mechanism for abolishing the Senate. And that's not surprising. It's a constitutional change, and part of it is also strategic. You want people's voices there so as to put pressure on legislatures so that they know where the people stand. There is no constitutional change here with the election. As long as each province continues to have its fair share of MPs, that's all the Constitution requires, is that BC has enough MPs to reflect its population, Saskatchewan, Newfoundland, etc. There's no constitutional change. Our tradition is that major legislative change, including major changes to our the Elections Act, get done through legislation. And we're not in a referendum democracy. And so the point is that there is no specific commitment to using a referendum. I could see some parties wanting it simply because it's a delay mechanism, or they think they can win it because inertia is, in a referendum, you start with 30% against because it's new, versus the leadership of a parliament saying, this is what we believe is necessary. So I believe that a strong and clear message during an electoral campaign does give a mandate, but if a party is elected with, ironically, under our current wonky system, with say 40% of the vote, and manages to get even over a majority of the seats, they're going to have to take into account that that mandate is a funny kind of false mandate in the same way as their majority is false.
That's the NDP's Craig Scott speaking about electoral reform. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.